Hello, I'm Russell Rowland, author of 56 Counties, A Montana Journey. Welcome to 56 Counties.
Kevin Kicking Woman grew up on the Blackfeet Reservation as the youngest of 15 children. After his mother left the family, he was shuttled around to various foster families where he suffered some of the most horrific trauma I've ever heard. After a stint in the military and working hard to get his teaching degree in Missoula, Kevin moved back to the reservation about 10 years ago for a teaching job. Last year, he became the first Native American to be named Teacher of the Year for Montana. Why don't you start off by telling me about your childhood? You were kind of shipped around to different foster homes. Because you came from a huge family, right?
Yeah, there's around 15 of us.
Right.
My mother had 13, and of course my dad had two more from my mother, or my mother and my dad. So she was married twice.
Okay. Yeah, so you've told me some stories about how hard that was, and I was just curious if we wanted to talk about that and then how that impacted you as a kid and how it's carried over into your adult life.
Yeah, you know, my mother left when I was 6 months old, and my dad tried to raise me, but he had trouble with alcohol. And so off and on for those 2 years, he tried to raise me, and I always wonder what happened in those 2 years. You know, who really took care of me, because I knew my dad couldn't do it. But at 2 or 3 years old, he gave me to a family to take care of me. And so actually it was the Takeskins family. And from what I hear, they did a pretty good job. But for whatever reason, my dad tried to take me back. Ooh. And but then he gave me to this other family, which I won't use their name. And I could vaguely remember them because some of the traumatic things that they did to me, and I'll talk about it on here because it's intense and severe. I remember they would put me in a high chair and feed me hot peppers, you know, and I'm only 4 years old maybe. And so I remember them burning. And the last thing they tried to do to me, and I still suffer today from my esophagus, is they gave me Drano. And it burned my esophagus so bad. And they actually left me there. No one is there. I was on the floor as a four-year-old kid. And it wasn't for a gentleman named Kenneth Olperson and his wife were friends of the family. And they came down there and saw me through the screen door laying on the floor. And they rushed me to the hospital. Wow. So I spent about a year or two in Seattle hospital, reconstructing my esophagus, which I still struggle with today. So one day they might have to do remove my esophagus and transplant and so on. But knock on wood, it's been good so far. That traumatic thing that happened to me there. And then finally I went back to another family, which were relatives, and the abuse didn't stop. I think, you know, you think back, the physical abuse, which was hard, very hard, but what was said to you, you mm-hmm. know, you don't know who your dad and mom is and all this stuff that growing up, you never amount to anything. And I was half Cree and half Blackfeet. Back then, those days, Blackfeet didn't get along with Crees. And so I was always this young, dirty Cree or something, you know. And so I had to deal with all that stuff and going on. And I had a brother that was with me, but he was everything to me. He was my only full brother out of the 15. And we kind of grew up together with similar things. And when he left him, I was 14 years old. And in that household, I used to have to be do the laundry. And I remember those old Ringer days, those old Ringer laundry washers and so on. And I used to do laundry, sweep the floor, do the dishes, chop wood, kindling. We had wood stove back in them days, and you cooked on a stove too. And so I was kind of this virtual, lack of a better word, slave to these people that I was basically at their beck and call. Well, I wasn't allowed to even go outside. They used to even, one of the lady used to put me in a dress and put makeup on me and say, this is my daughter. And I remember the trauma of, And I think back at how I used to feel and so on. Even if I walked by her and made a breeze, I got hit for making her cold,
Oh,
you know.
geez.
With him leaving, I got to a point in my life. I'll tell you a story. When I was 9 years old, I used to have to pluck gray hair out of this girl lady's head for hours, and I'd get so tired and so on. And I knew one time she said, "Go find those tweezers." And so I went looking, and I couldn't find them. And as I was standing there, I just would drop to my knees. Well, she threw back in the 70s. You remember those hard heel platform shoes they used to have? And she threw it across the room and knocked me out. Well, I didn't realize she knocked me out. When I got up off the floor, I was touching the back of my head. And she said, "You stay in this room." And I sat at the edge of the bed and I began to cry. And right then and there, I seemed to give up. I said, "You know, I'm going to do myself in. I was going to kill myself and I was going to go kill her." And as I was sitting there, I felt this really warm feeling come into my body. And this, in my mind, these words came to me: "Don't give up. There's a fire in your heart." 9-year-old boy, I just kind of stretched my spine a little bit and I wiped my tears. Everything they did to me, from beating me, I wouldn't cry anymore. And I remember looking them dead in the eye when they would hit me and I wouldn't cry. And it seemed like it scared them. And I don't know, I just, the pain I've had in all my life and all my years, I just couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't give tears. And so I would walk outside, and I wear these bracelets called "The Sun Is My Witness," and that's the book I had, the short play I had written. And I would go out and sit on the back porch in the morning time and watch the sun rise, because I made it one more day. So I was, "The Sun Is My Witness." And so at 14, my brother left, and that was my heart and soul. And he had enough. He was 16 then, and he went to some relatives in Browning, and that's when I decided that enough was enough, and I just start going out. I'd do my chores, but I'd just go out. I didn't care what happened. And I came home one night, and one of my older relatives, those old pigtails from off a dryer, I remember he took the end of it and hit me in the head. And I started to bleed. Well, I went to sleep that night, and about breaking day, I decided that, you know, at 14 years old, I was gonna had enough, and I was gonna walk into the welfare office in Browning, in which I did. I get up early that morning, and I began to walk 7, 7, 8 miles into town. I went to the welfare office, and I walked and knocked on the door, and it was about 7:45, and this lady answered, "How can I help you?" And all I could say was, "I'm abused. I have nowhere to go." Guy named Stanley Spotted Wolf, I'll never forget him. He came in, and there was foster homes in between here and there because I had nowhere to go, and so they would put me in this. But this one family, they're on vacation, and I happened to stay with their daughters, and they said, "Stay with us. Their mom and dad's out on vacation for 2 weeks," and so I stayed with them. When their mom and dad came back, I remember I felt like a pet, you know, because they're like, I was outside playing basketball because I didn't want to go in there while they were there, and they're gonna say, "We're gonna talk to our parents about keeping you." And so I was like, okay. So anyway, they said they would take a chance on me without even knowing me. Family, we were farm and ranch, Ruth and Elmer. Meals were great. Everything. My first birthday I ever had was when I was 15 years old. I remember I didn't know how to react to it. I didn't know how to react to it. I felt it was kind of corny because I had friends there and it was kind of a surprise and so on. But I made it. And I remember when I graduated high school. So I wrote down these goals, and I had six goals, I believe, I wrote down. And well, later in life, I was in my 30s or so on, and I went out to the house and where I grew up at the last foster home. And my foster mother said, "You should go down to that old room and clean your room. That still some stuff in there of yours." So I went down, and back in them days, they used to have those trunks, those big trunks. So I opened it, and here was that goal list. And one, get married, which I am, 34 years. Two is have three kids, which I have five, and I adopted two, seven. Buy my own house, which I did. Join the military, I did. Be right with the Creator, which is every day. It's an ongoing thing. And the other one was graduate. And so I have my BA and master's. And so I reached all those goals, and I just remember getting a chill saying, wow, this is amazing. I never let that fire go out. The trauma and the things that happened to me that are very traumatic, but I deal with it the best I can. You don't come out unscathed.
I was just going to ask, so have you had any PTSD with all that? Because it seems like it would be hard to avoid.
Well, yes, I know I'm very open about it. I do take meds, and I have to, get counseling once a month. And so I encourage anybody that's going through this type of thing, step out there and get help. That's what sincerely helps me, what I have to do and so on. And the military VA takes good care of me.
How did you come to become a teacher? Was that something that you were thinking about beforehand, or did you just kind of accidentally find your way into that profession, or how did that happen?
Well, it kind of was off and on. I always was a teacher of songs or some form of your culture. But, like I say, when I got out of the military, 91, I was on a helitech crew out of Missoula. I was there 10 years there. In one summer, I blew my knee. And so I wasn't able to. And a gentleman named Leon Rattler, he asked if I would come work a summer camp. I went and worked it, and man, I loved it. I mean, we're all these high school kids and whatnot, explored the land in Glacier National Park at a KOA up where we camped out. Every day was something new. There was a job position open for a Blackfeet language teacher. And mind you, I didn't really know Blackfeet. So in the interview place was three fluent Blackfeet speakers. And I'm like, what am I doing? Laura Jarvis was the director then. She was fluent in Blackfoot. And she said in Blackfoot speaking to me, and I said, I'm sorry, ma'am, I can't understand you. And she said, what do you know? And I told her, I said, I'll sing you any song you want. And so she tested me, and I was like, wow, I sang the songs. And she was kind of, and she said, are you willing to learn? I said, of course, that's why I'm here. I got the job. And I remember going into class, and the students, it was a middle school, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. And I said, all right, kids, let me see what you know. I said, tell me some animals in Blackfoot. And they were telling me, and I was writing these animals down. I start learning on the fly. But I was away from my family. And for 5 years, I worked at Browning Middle School. But being away from my family, I wanted to go back to Missoula because that's where I was established, my house and my wife and kids. And so I went back, and then I worked law enforcement at the corrections. And, for 7, 8 years. While I was in there, I remember going, and when you work as an officer, a corrections officer, you lose, it's us against them. And you start losing that humanity towards other individuals. So you're always getting skeptical, even of people on the outside. And I didn't like that because I saw suicide. I think the trauma of how I grew up and seeing that, one day the guy, didn't. He tried it, but he didn't succeed. Getting off shift, and I told him, I said, now I got to write a report, stay after work. I was more concerned about the report than this guy just tried to take his life. And right then and there, I went home, and I did a resignation letter, and I went down to the schools, college, and I enrolled in school. Then I graduated with my BA and Master's in Native American Studies and Cultural Anthropology, Music Ethnology, and Linguistics. And in Missoula, it's pretty tough to get a job. So I taught at Loyola High School. I worked half time at the university, and I did the adjunct stuff. One day, the superintendent called me about 7 years ago, 8 years ago. She said, do you want a job at a Browning? And I'm like, what? She said, we need you to come down if you want to come down. So we negotiated a contract and so on. And I said, I'm going to go back home. And so I came back. And so I've been teaching off and on for the last 25 years. This probably gave my last stint just because I just thoroughly love it. I love being home. Although Missoula is my home, that's where I'll retire. But I just love being here.
Well, and I know teaching the language is still a huge part of what you're focused on, and you've got a lot of a team there that's really working hard on that. How much growth has there been as far as the percentage of people on the Blackfeet Reservation learning the language?
You know, I don't know the percentage, but I know that we're making steps. You know, with our new director, Robert Hall, he's phenomenal. I just can't say enough about this guy, what he's doing with the language and this new called the William Big Bull writing system. So anyway, I bought in to Robert's system and learning the diacritics, the allophones, the vowel combinations, the morphemes and syntax, everything in that language. And I have made leaps and bounds. And kids, I bet you we have, out of the 7 years, we probably have about eight kids that are semi-fluent. After they were learning, you'd see those light bulbs going off, like, wow, this is cool. And they couldn't get enough. And it was almost to the point, was like, how can I teach them more? So they challenged you too. Like I say, when people speak Blackfoot to me, it's hard for me to understand because I rarely hear it and to filter it. And after perhaps a conversation, I sit there and said, oh, okay, I see what they're saying. And so about me speaking it, I can do it better, speaking it and understanding it. But it has made a big difference. And, you know, I was just thinking about that this morning. Within the probably the last 2 years, I dream in Blackfoot sometimes.
Oh, really?
And I've never had that. And so that's leaps and bounds for me. I think in Blackfoot, I'll be driving and I'll be looking out at things, you know, be like saying things in Blackfeet in my mind and so on. So, and every morning, get up before the sun rises, I greet the sun. And I've been doing that for the last 5 years. I've really embraced the Blackfoot ways of knowing. And so getting up in morning time, I guess the way I could put it is there's Ishtapatapio. That is the source of life, the universe. And through Ishtapatapio, Papastatuki, creator, works in that energy, but we call spirit, right? And there are things within that you ask for in a morning. And one is the Spomita peaks, the above beings. And those above beings are Iskachikikamix, the seven brothers, the Big Dipper. Oh yes, the belly button of the universe, the Polaris, that fixed star. There's all stories about these and Mohpokwakes, the lost children, the Pleiades, the Orion Nebula, Katoyesix, Blood Clot Boy came and rid this world of evil. Ipisawat's, Morning Star, Mars and Jupiter, Bahxipisawatz, their mistaken morning star. Those are the above beings you call on that spirit to come help us. Then you got Suita peaks, those water beings. We have the Shishtikiahquinamandu, the beaver bundle. We have the otter, we have the fish, and all this that deal with the water we call upon. Then the other is Sahkomita peaks. These earth beings, the man, the four-legged, the beak, the feathered, all these grass and trees and rocks, everything on this earth that we believe have energy and life. And then the last is the Natuita peaks. And the Natuita peaks are the spirit beings, our ancestors who crossed over. We call upon all those to help us. And we have what we word called Kakioksen. And I asked the elder, I said, what's it mean? And to me, it meant alignment. Said, well, he said, the best way I put it, he said, if you act like a cat all your life, you're probably going to be a cat. So that's what he said. And so when you find Kakioksen, you're able to find Matapi, the true human being. And so I'll share a song with you I use in a morning. Wake that spirit up, I guess, and call upon. The songs are big to us because songs, they bring things to life. And they literally, we believe that if you go into a ceremony and you grab a sacred item from that, perhaps that bundle, well, that person that grabs it brought it to life, and the song brings it to life, and that reciprocation of energy going around with everyone, that everything comes to life and vibrant. And so we do renewal every year, same songs, same stories. We do these ceremonies for renewal. And that's what Blackfoot Way of Life, we renew ourselves every morning. And so this is the song that I use. Kima, when you think about Blackfoot ceremony, Narses Blood said it best. He said, sometimes people say, why don't those natives just get over it with all the trauma that happened to them in the past? He said, this is why we need our ceremonies. He said, our ceremonies are from the past so we can heal in the present so we can move on to the future.
Well, I think it's so cool that you were named Montana Teacher of the Year, but I think it's really sad that you were the first Native. I mean, I don't know how long that award's been around, but that seems pretty awful that all these years there's never been a Native given that honor. But tell me about what that was like. You must have been really honored, but also pretty surprised.
Yeah, you know, I had a what started out. I had a gentleman out of Missoula, Ray Kingfisher. He called me in April or March of last year, and he said, "I just want to let you know I nominated you for Teacher of the Year." And he said, "Is it okay? I know that if I do it, you'll follow through because there was so much work after he just did the nomination, but there's so much I had to do." I said, without knowing if you win it or not, and I said, all right, I'll do it. So, of course, there were questions and so on, and I did all what I needed to do and submitted my app. Then it got to the point where, like, when you didn't hear nothing, I guess that's a good thing, you know? And while I didn't know, I went down, and this is crazy. Just before, about 3 weeks before the interviews, well, my daughter, I found out that she had thyroid cancer. And my mind was all over the place. I couldn't study. And I actually was going to give up. I was very pale to what my daughter is going through and what. And they said, just do it, you know, do. So I went down and studied for the questions. And I thought, I've been doing this for so many years. Why do I need to, you know, it's kind of a life thing teaching. So I went into the interviews. Well, I didn't know that night, my principal already knew. They called her and told her I got it. And so she was lying to me all this time.
Oh, really?
And so I didn't put nothing together. And I just go in there, ask her periodically, did you hear anything? She'd say, no. And my family knew 2 weeks before I knew.
Did they really? Oh, that's hilarious.
So I'm sitting at the school, and October 28th, in fact, they called an assembly that morning. Well, I wasn't going to go because there was a couple fights in the school that morning. And I thought, they're just going to. It's just going to be a negative assembly. So finally, I said, oh, I'm going to go down there. So we're sitting there and whatnot, and this podium's up there. And I'm saying, why is the podium up there? Then I look out and I see a guy with a camera, and I'm like, we're getting, students are going to get scolded. I said, why is he there? Well, as I looked down, then all my family came out, and all these singers with war bonnets came out. Then it hit me like, whoa, then superintendent came out into public schools. And that's when I realized it was perhaps more than just for me to see all the students embrace me winning. And as that first Native male to win this award, to see these kids happy, coming up and hugging me, and we were dancing, and the war haulers and the rattling of tongues from the women and the songs that were sung. But when I look back, I take from it my family being there and the students getting to see one of their own win such a prestigious. award.
So talk about the trip to DC, and so you were up for the National Teacher of the Year, so you got to go to that, all those events. Well, that must have been really fun.
Yeah, you know, going and seeing all 55 other teachers, and wow, you talk about some dynamic people. I mean, you got New York, California, Maine, all these, wow. And so here's a guy from Browning, Montana, you know, yeah. A school of 600 students and so on. And going and seeing how much the people cared about each other. And that day came when he was going to visit the White House. I was nervous. I guess I was overwhelmed. My wife went down to get her hair fixed. And I sat there and I cried because of the journey I had in life. Mm. I was thankful and I wished my dad could have been there. I remember I just said this, I always refer to this, I said, this kid shouldn't be here. And I cried, and after I kind of cut my emotions and whatnot, and I was thankful. And so we got all gussied up and food on and whatnot, and joined, and we got on these buses and we headed out. Wow, you know, to go through and they introduced you, to get a card, they gave them ahead of time, and there was just this red carpet. And all the Army, Marines, and playing with all their instruments. Mm. So you went around, you went up, and as you got into the White House, there was even more people walking around in a stair. Music and hors d'oeuvres and water and champagne. And you had the Red Room, this Velvet Room, all these rooms that you hear about.
Mm-hmm.
But it was surreal to know that all of the presidents that walked through those rooms, sat in those rooms, named after them, all these pictures all over that we got to see.
Mm-hmm.
Obama, and see JFK's, and Reagan, and Michelle Obama. And it was just a surreal moment that going in and sitting down. And I don't know why I was so nervous, because as far as how do I use my forks or my spoons, you know, because they had, like, me in my world, just one fork for everything, you know. And then as we're sitting there, and all of a sudden this music started to play, it was a president song. Then Joe Biden walks in, he said some words and whatnot, and he left. To leave there and I to be treated like royalty, it was phenomenal. It was, and mostly for me, to let see my wife to go through this. When we sat in tables, they actually made you sit away from your significant others.
Ooh, just so you could get to know other people.
Yeah, and so I'd look over across the room, and there she was talking. I remember she was talking to Kamala's husband.
Yeah.
You know, and so to see all these people you see on MSNBC or whatever you watch, and they were there. So that was amazing. I mean, it was just the cherry on the top.
It's quite a journey from where you started. Thank you so much for joining me, Kevin.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Roland.
All right. You have a great year, okay?
I want to thank Kevin Kicking Woman for joining me for this conversation, and Phil Auberg for his fabulous musical accompaniment.